The story behind a tragic image, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The photo has gone viral. A father and his young daughter drowned trying to swim across the U.S.-Mexico border. In their native El Salvador, the story behind that image is well known.
When you're here, when you have a daughter, and your daughter gets sick, and you have no money to buy the medicine for your daughter, that when you are desperate, you will make a desperate decision like what they did.
Also, how some of the world's most developed countries are clinging to coal and subsidizing its use, both at home and abroad.
They're locking in other countries who are at earlier stages of development to sort of a dirty, outdated energy system.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. This week, two emotional moments jarred the ongoing immigration debate. The photo, you know the one, of a father and his toddler who drowned while trying to cross a river. We'll get to that in a moment. The other was an investigative report detailing inhumane conditions for children in a migrant detention center in Texas. That seemed to light a fire under Congress. The House and Senate have now both passed their own spending bills to address the lack of resources at the border, each measure worth about $4.5 billion. In the House bill, Democrats included rules that would retain some of the president's immigration policy. We asked The World's Monica Campbell to weigh in. She reports on immigration for us.
I think it's good to think of it as an emergency spending bill. This is a response to the conditions at the border right now. The money is mostly going to go to treat migrants and particularly migrant children. Largely, it requires border officials to also establish new health and safety standards for migrants in its custody. And doing that takes a lot of capacity, more people, more administration. That's where a lot of this money is going to go toward.
And the bill had some last-minute changes to appease some Democrats in Congress, some who in the end did not vote for it. What were they unhappy with, and what kind of changes were they asking for?
Well, there was unhappiness in terms of funding any bill that would give the Trump administration a back door to boost more security and enforcement on the border. So what you saw among some Democrats were the demand for restrictions on funding for ICE, for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to not increase, for example, detention beds in this bill. The restrictions on holding children in custody, this is key. The changes that they pushed for and actually got into this bill were limits on how long children can stay in what they're calling influx shelters. The Democrats demand a limit of 90 days in terms of keeping these children in custody. So it was very much restrictions on how migrant children are treated in particular, and to keep any of this funding away from ICE, for example.
Do you think this bill is likely to pass the Senate and the White House?
It's unsure. The Senate has its own bill. It has fewer restrictions. It has bipartisan support, but they have to come to a compromise. So we'll see if both chambers can come together on a compromise bill. What that type of bill looks like that eventually reaches Trump's desk, will he feel pressured to put some sort of funding forward? We could see a stalemate, or we could see Trump give in to the public pressure that is rising.
Let me switch gears briefly, Monica. There's a tragic photo. I don't know any other way of putting it. You brought it to my attention yesterday, in fact. It's gone viral since then. A photograph of a migrant father and his child who drowned in the Rio Grande. What have we learned about them?
Well, his name is Oscar Martinez. He's 25 years old. The photograph shows him and his toddler daughter lying face down on the banks of the Rio Grande along the U.S.-Texas border. They're from El Salvador, and the river is at a faster current right now. And they were carried away, and it's an absolutely tragic photo. These types of photos have existed for years. If you look back, historical images, they're not new photos. They're not new images. But what we're seeing right now is a really, really horrible, tragic rise in the number of people who are dying along the border at rates that haven't been seen. So this photo brings that reality to light, the routes that people are taking, because they don't feel that if they go up to a port of entry, that if they go up to a border official, that they will have a chance to enter the United States. So this is people being pushed into dangerous parts of the border. We'll see people crossing the deserts. You know, the temperatures are going to rise with the summer heat. And this is the reality of people feeling that there's no other way in to the United States but crossing a horrible river or a horrible desert.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Let's talk about that photo now. The Mexican newspaper La Jornada published it this week. It is hard to take in. The photo shows that Salvadoran man, Oscar Martinez, and his toddler, Valeria, laying face down in shallow water. They had drowned in the Rio Grande this week. The image prompted fresh discussions on the realities that many migrants face trying to cross the border. Jose Cabezas is a photojournalist in El Salvador. He was at the home of Rosa Ramirez today. It's her son and granddaughter who are in that photo.
She was very shocked with the whole thing about the picture circulating everywhere in the social media and the news. She told me that she didn't want to talk anymore about it.
Ramirez told Cabezas that her son had been living in her home before he left. He'd been looking for a better life for his daughter, her granddaughter. She clutched some of the little girl's things.
She showed me some granddaughter's toys, which is these two plush puppets he was holding in her hand. You know, these people, when they leave, they take almost just the necessary, not toys. So they leave everything behind.
Now Ramirez is just waiting for the bodies of her son and granddaughter to arrive back in El Salvador.
I think you can feel the pain in their home, in their neighborhood.
Cabezas says the risks of migrating are well known across El Salvador. It's a journey familiar to Salvadorans and other families from Central America trying to get to the United States. Emilia Estrada operates a small hotel in Santa Tecla, just outside of San Salvador. This photo tells such a tragic story. Are people in El Salvador talking about it? Has it struck a chord there?
Yes, everybody's talking about it. You know, with the family, what they lost, because they didn't have much here, but everybody's pretty sad about it.
Is this kind of image shocking to you?
Absolutely. It's especially because we people here in El Salvador, we love our country, you know. We love our culture. We love our food. We don't want to leave the country, but people have to leave the country. So especially for that, you know, people go because they feel they don't have no other option.
Do you know many Salvadorans who are hoping to cross the border and make their way to the U.S.?
People outside in the rural areas, a lot of people does. And I visit a lot of the place outside the city, and that is the dream of all young people, you know, from 18 years to 25 years. That's what people is dreaming about.
Are they dreaming about being in the U.S. or is it still the violence?
Being in the U.S., especially because a lot of people made it already and they talk about their experiences and they say, you can come here. I can help you.
We've also heard that there's a lot of gang violence and police extortion that make people want to flee. Has that diminished?
The gang violence is very hard in certain places of the metropolitan area of San Salvador. But also, you know, the thing is that people is scared in general, not only of gangs. People wake up every day in the morning, they go to work, but the most they could make, nothing to survive. That money is not enough. But then you get in the bus and then you get robbed in the bus. You being assaulted and living the violence day a day, because the people that is in the street, taking the buses, going to work, and they are the people that suffer more the violence that we had in El Salvador in general.
Well, as I said, you're just outside of San Salvador, the capital. You do know something about the part of San Salvador that Oscar Martinez and his daughter, the subjects of this horrible photo, where they were from. What is life like there in that neighborhood?
It's pretty tough. That's one of the places that you don't want to be there, because it's pretty tough with the gang violence.
Is there anything, Emilia, about your own family story that makes you understand even deeper why this mother, father, and young daughter would take such a risk?
Yes, I think most of Salvadorians, we have a story about immigration that we experienced personally. My mom has to leave for economical reasons when I was super young. to the United States, you know, and I have to stay at home and take care of my two brothers and two sisters. And I was 16 years old, you know, I wasn't ready to actually take care of a whole family, but I did. And I remember how broken I feel because my mom wasn't there. And my mom wanted to be there with us because she loved us so much. And she called crying and she asked me about how everybody's doing, if my little sister is eating. And I understand how it is that the families get separated for economical reasons. And then slowly she took all my brothers and sisters. She was legal. And I stay in my country, but I feel like that experience marked completely my life, you know, of being separated of the person that you love the most. And to wake up to a reality that is super tough because you are poor.
Do you think this very upsetting photograph of Oscar Martinez and his daughter is likely to make someone in El Salvador decide not to try to make the journey to the U.S.?
Yeah, I think definitely this picture will impact in a lot of people's decisions. But a lot of decisions are already made, you know. There's still smugglers taking people from El Salvador and people paying. I mean, the thing is that it's already so many years of people leaving the country and families are already there, you know, and families want to be together. And some of these families are just going to be together no matter what happens. So maybe this will make a lot of young people that think that that's the only way to get out of your situation. Obviously, they will think about it. But when you're here, when you have a daughter and your daughter gets sick, and you have no money to buy the medicine for your daughter, you get so frustrated, you know, that when you are desperate, you will make a desperate decision like what they did. What they did wasn't a decision just because, oh, I feel like I want to be in Los Angeles, you know, I want to take a vacation. The decision was a decision that was taken under circumstances that were desperate circumstances, you know, like life or death circumstances. So I don't know. People will still probably doing and putting, taking these high risk decisions, not because they want to, but because they feel it's the only decision they can make.
Emilia Estrada operates a small hotel in Santa Tecla, just outside San Salvador. Emilia, I know it's hard to talk about this photograph, but I really appreciate your taking the time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up in a few minutes on the show, abortions are illegal in Argentina, but women there are finding ways around the law.
We think that if a woman doesn't want to keep a pregnancy, she's in danger if you don't help her.
Our story from Argentina, that's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump's support of coal energy was a hallmark of his campaign for the White House. But some countries like the UK are working hard to leave coal behind. In Kenya, a tribunal this afternoon blocked construction of what would have been the country's first ever coal power plant. The government-backed project was planned for a site in the coastal town of Lamu. We asked the BBC's Victor Kinani in Nairobi to explain the ruling.
The tribunal said that the process was hurried to meet the deadlines, and the locals were not informed of the effects of the project, such as it will bring asthma, breathing difficulties, premature deaths, and acid rain, which will kill fish, plants, and even affect forest and soil vegetation. And so it seems like the environmental impact assessment risk that was done was not fully disclosed to the public and especially to the locals in Lamu.
How close was the project to actually breaking ground? Like, was this verdict something of a surprise?
The project has been on since 2013. Actually, this case has been running in court for 3 years now. Mm. For those 3 years, as the case was continuing, there were no conservatory orders in court to stop its construction. And so the project is almost towards completion. But now with this tribunal, the findings of this tribunal, then it sets back and quashes everything that has been done and halts the whole process.
So you're saying there is a coal power plant. It's just not going to operate at this point.
Yes.
Wow. This plant was constructed in Lamu. Describe that city to us. Where is it?
Lamu is actually in the coastal part of Kenya. It's one of the places that is very beautiful, actually. Many of the locals there still use donkeys to carry luggage and do not have like powered boats and things like that. And actually, it was recognized by UNESCO to be a World Heritage Site.
Also on the environmental front, Kenya had committed to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2030. So surely a coal power plant would have upended those plans. Did the tribunal talk about that?
The tribunal did not touch on that. In that same coastal town, coincidentally, Kenya receives carbon credits, which is money given by countries which do run big and huge factories that add up to the pollution in the world. And so these carbon credits have been used to buy mangrove trees, which are said to absorb more carbon from the air and to bury it and process it. So it beats logic that on one hand, the country is ready to receive money as carbon credits and, you know, to inject that into planting mangroves. But on the other, it wants to set up a coal power plant that is known and is for sure will increase pollution.
Finally, Victor, have you heard any reaction from China? Because now they've put up all these costs up front for this coal power plant, and it's going to be a ghost power plant now.
I have not heard, unfortunately, from the Chinese government, but what I've received like moments ago is a statement from Amu Power, the Kenyan power company that is putting up the coal power plant. Mm. It says that following the ruling of the National Environment Tribunal this afternoon to conduct a fresh environmental impact assessment study, Amu Power has taken note of the concerns raised in the ruling and is committed to work with all stakeholders involved to ensure that all matters are addressed in totality.
So is this then not a final decision? I mean, it sounds like the Amu Power wants to try and continue.
From the judgment by the tribunal, Amu Power were given 30 days to appeal the decision that had been made.
The BBC's Victor Kanani speaking with us from Nairobi. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coal will also be on the minds of climate activists at the G20 summit this weekend in Japan. 10 years ago, the world's leading economies agreed to stop subsidizing fossil fuels. But a new study says those subsidies have actually gone up, way up, in the last few years. Ipek Gentsu is with the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's the lead author of that report. Ipek, clearly the G20 countries as a whole have not yet made good on that promise to phase out coal subsidies. What did your study find?
Yes, unfortunately, you're right. They have not. Our study actually found $64 billion of support per year being provided to coal, both the production of coal and its consumption. We also found, which was especially alarming, that subsidies to coal-fired power have increased if you compare them with data we found in 2013-14. So within a three-year period, they've gone up from $17 billion per year up to almost triple at $47 billion per year.
Yeah, it is pretty astounding. So talking the talk, but not walking the walk. Which countries are providing the highest level of subsidies, or at least highest relative to their GDP, and where does the U.S. fit into all of that?
So we actually caution against doing so many comparisons because obviously we know these countries are at different stages of their development. They have different energy needs. But of course, as you might expect, we do find China, India, Japan, some of the largest economies providing the highest levels of subsidies. The US and the UK come next. And the US is actually providing some of the highest levels of subsidies for coal production. The UK, on the other hand, is providing support to close up mining sites and paying off inherited liabilities. So, as I mentioned, you know, countries are at different stages of their development. And moreover, we don't actually know the full figure because a lot of subsidies are hidden.
Which may make this next question a little difficult to answer. Are all these subsidies to domestic coal plants or do they include investment in plants beyond countries' own borders?
They are for both. So not only are they making these decisions domestically to continue a coal-based energy system, but they're locking in other countries who are at earlier stages of their development to a sort of a dirty, outdated energy system.
I mean, just practically speaking, the news is baffling. Why this stubbornly high continued investment in coal, given first, the rapidly escalating impacts of the climate crisis on one hand, and also the rapidly falling costs of renewable and other low carbon alternatives on the other hand.
It's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, Our research didn't actually look into the reasons behind this ongoing support, but we do expect it's partly due to the pressure coming from the coal sector and those involved. But we also partly expect it's because governments are taking over the responsibility when other investors are pulling out of these sectors. So we do understand that this sector needs support in the transition away, and it does take leadership for governments to move away from this energy source. So governments just have to put any remaining resources that they have into a just transition for the workers and communities in this sector and make sure that they move away as soon as possible.
Before I let you go, Ipek, let me just switch to this weekend's G20 meeting itself in Osaka. There are reports that Japan is watering down language on fighting climate change in the joint document at the end in order to appease the U.S., which, as we know, under Trump has moved sharply away from taking action on the climate crisis. If the G20 does come out of this meeting without a strong statement on fighting the climate crisis, what will that mean for the global effort to get serious about climate?
Well, you know, the messages that come out of these G20 leaders' gatherings are important because they provide signals for businesses, investors, numerous other stakeholders. So we all know that the world is moving away from fossil fuels. Renewables are doing incredibly well. So governments not putting their weight behind climate action sufficiently is simply delaying the transition, which will just make it more dangerous for the planet and more costly for businesses to actually make the switch in the coming years.
Ipek Genchsu at the Overseas Development Institute in London, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Companies all over the world are being targeted by hackers. And more often than you think, those firms are paying hefty ransoms to get their data back. An aluminum company in Norway decided not to do that.
I think in general it's a very bad idea to pay. It's probably financing other sorts of crime.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. As you heard earlier this hour, the House and Senate have both passed funding measures to address the lack of resources at border detention centers. As they reconcile the differences in the bills, it's unknown which provisions President Trump will support or veto. One detention center is Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and it has a complicated history. A group of indigenous activists has been collecting clothes and toiletries for migrant families being held there. The activists have also been protesting. Mary Topham directs the American Indian Movement in Indian Territory, Oklahoma.
The protest was organized by a group called Suru for Solidarity, which was the Japanese Americans group. They reached out to us, the American Indian Movement, AIM Indian Territory, because they were aware that we have been going through this for over 500 years, and they wanted to kind of make sure they weren't offending anyone by coming here. We partnered up with them to continue helping them get things in order for the protest.
Are these protests ongoing?
Yes, it is. I believe there is another one that is supposed to be happening here on July 12th. And then throughout the United States, they are holding protests out there.
For someone who's never heard of Fort Sill in Oklahoma, what is the significance of this place to both the indigenous community, the Japanese community, really everyone who's shown up?
Fort Sill is a military base that is here in Lawton, Oklahoma. It was also made the prisoner of war camp to the Apaches, and where Geronimo was eventually imprisoned and died and is buried there, along with other members of his band. So the military base alone captured our own people and made them be in camps there. Some were released and some died there. And then you have the Fort Scusu Indian boarding school, where a lot of Native American children were made to go to school there. That's the significance of it for the Native American community. For the Japanese community, it was used as camps during the World War II, when they United States were going around and collecting Japanese American families and placing them into camps. So kind of the same history as our people is the same history of the Japanese Americans that are now happening to our relatives from the south of the border.
There were also demonstrators from Black Lives Matter there, and I kind of get the sense of enormous unity. Since you've been a director at AIM, was this protest the first time that you've seen this kind of unity with, you know, Japanese, Black Lives Matter, indigenous, migrant community, all kind of coming together?
The American Indian movement's been around for over 52 years, and we've always stood in solidarity with the African community and the Hispanic community, with Cesar Chavez and the Brown Berets. We still stand in solidarity with them. But this is definitely the very first time that we have stood in solidarity with the Japanese American, which I really think is very important, because it does show unity. You know, we are in 2019. And we as minorities need to come together and realize that we all share almost the exact same history when it comes to the United States government and the military.
Do you worry that the history of Fort Sill and all these interest groups showing up to support migrant communities might actually dilute the attention on the migrant communities themselves?
I think it's going to show that we as a community will not allow abuse and mistreatment of the migrant communities, showing them that we're not going to allow history to repeat itself.
Mary Topalm is the director of the American Indian Movement Indian Territory Chapter. She's been speaking with us from Lawton, Oklahoma, right next to the Migrant Detention Center at Fort Sill. Mary, thank you very much.
And thank you.
In the U.S., abortion has been legal since Roe v. Wade in 1973, though people on all sides of the debate see the Supreme Court ruling as increasingly vulnerable. But some countries may be heading in the opposite direction on abortion rights. In Argentina, there's a strong push to legalize abortion. Over the next 2 days, we'll hear how Argentines are framing the abortion debate there. Today, we start with the story of one woman in Buenos Aires who found herself in a difficult situation. Here's the world's Allison Herrera.
Joanna is nervous. She's come to meet me in the waiting room at Casa Fusa, a small private clinic tucked away on a busy street near downtown Buenos Aires. She's here because she's pregnant, and she doesn't want to be. I'm not using her last name to protect her identity.
I am nervous, but I am quite sure about what I am doing, so that helps me to stay calm.
When Joanna found out she was pregnant, she called a consejería, a local hotline here for women. They gave her information about where to go get pills, misoprostol, to end her pregnancy, and what to expect when she took them.
My main goal was to go somewhere where they wouldn't judge me and where they wouldn't waste my time, because I knew I had to act fast.
But the pills didn't work. Joanna says she got nauseous, weak, and feverish, but the pregnancy didn't end. She was scared, so she came to this clinic for help. They charge about $250 for a surgical abortion. At 27, Joanna says she's just not ready to take care of another child.
I already have 2 children, and I don't want more. I'm good with the way things are. Plus, I am very focused on my studies and getting a degree. So this wasn't planned. The first thing I thought was that I cannot believe this is happening. I cannot face this situation right now.
But in Argentina, abortion is illegal, except in cases of rape, incest, and when a woman's life is in danger. Still, there are ways to get around the law. Virginia Braga is a psychologist at the Casa Fusa Clinic.
We think that if a woman doesn't want to keep a pregnancy, she's in danger if you don't help her.
Braga says the fact that Joanna says she's unable to care for another child means having the baby would put her at risk. So under the law, Joanna can get what's known as an ILE protocol, a legal interruption of pregnancy.
86 article of the penal code in Argentina says the abortion can be legal if danger for life or health.
Braga explains that the law allows providers to consider the whole picture of a woman's health.
So it's mental health, it's social health, and it's physical health too.
Braga says the law allows for this interpretation, and her clinic doesn't face protests or legal problems. But she says not all providers interpret the law this way.
Not all the doctors or psychologists, they don't think this way.
In fact, just across town at a large public hospital, the chief physician, Dr. Eda Abad Monetti, tells me she wouldn't perform an abortion.
Si ustedes matan a un adolescente, están matando a un adulto.
She says, if you kill a teenager, what you're killing is a future adult who might be a great father or a mother or a doctor or some sort of genius who develops a cure for cancer. We just don't know who that person would have been. She says the same is true for that cell egg. If it's nurtured properly, it will grow to be a full human being who is going to be someone someday. And she says the other doctors at the hospital won't perform abortions either, even in cases of rape and incest.
Gracias.
Joanna sits in the waiting room with her mother, ready to go home. She tells me at first she had second thoughts about getting an abortion.
I feel like I have to make a huge effort to overcome the nagging question. Is it okay that I am doing this? Even though I am certain this is the right thing for me.
Joanna says in order to get the time off of work for the abortion, she had to tell her boss that she was going to the dentist. She says her coworkers wouldn't have approved, but she says she's grateful that she had a support network that helped her get here and get around the law. For The World, Alison Herrera, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Tomorrow, as activists push to legalize abortion in Argentina, they get pushed back. They're being called elitist.
You are middle-income, white women, academic, only from the cities. And we got a lot of that argument against us.
That's tomorrow here on The World. Israel is watching the confrontation between the United States and Iran closely. Israel could easily get dragged into any military conflict. Iran's ally, Hezbollah, has tens of thousands of rockets pointed at Israel from its bases in neighboring Lebanon. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is giving the White House his full support, but is his own country behind him? Shlomo Brahm is a former brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Force and now works at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. Shlomo Brahm, is there any consensus in Israel's defense and foreign policy establishment over Iran and what to do?
I don't think there is a consensus. I think that a large part of the Israeli defense and policy community was not happy of, for example, of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, because they saw that although this agreement was far from being perfect and it has some very important weaknesses, it was better than no agreement at all. And so far, there is no reason to think that this kind of assessment is wrong. Because, okay, there is a very strong pressure on Iran with the sanctions. Mm. And Iran is in a very poor economic situation. But that didn't change Iran's determination to continue with its current policies in the Middle East.
Yes,
so it's far from a consensus in Israel whether this American policy that is supported by the Israeli government is the right policy.
So given all that, how much support do you think the government in Israel could get from the Israeli public for a regional conflict?
Well, as usual, it will get a lot of support at the beginning of the conflict, because when a conflict starts, then people tend, to gather around the flag. But what will happen later is depending on the nature of the conflict, the damages that we will have, and the failures or successes that we will have. So one can very hardly predict what will be the reaction of the Israeli public opinion.
But when Israelis hear things like things they've heard before from Iranian officials, like we're going to erase Israel from the map if this continues, how do Israelis react? How do they react today?
Well, Israelis agree in principle with the government that Iran is an enemy that we should deal with, because it is actually, I think, the only state in the Middle East that doesn't accept the existence of the state of Israel and want to see the end of it. But that doesn't mean that there is no debate concerning the ways this threat is to be dealt with.
In your judgment, Shlomo Abram, is a confrontation with Iran at all in Israel's interest?
I don't think that it is in Israeli interests. I think that it's the Israeli interest to delay this kind of conflict with Iran as much as possible. And if it's possible, even to prevent it from happening at any time.
Yeah, how far would Israeli officials go to prevent that? I mean, if Donald Trump were, say, pulled into a conflict with Iran by his security advisors, would Benjamin Netanyahu try and resist? Would he try and dissuade them from doing this?
No, I don't think he will do it, because his basic policies are dependent on the close relationship with the Trump administration. So he would prefer not to oppose the policies or the decisions of this administration, paying for that any reasonable possible cost. Of course, if the cost will be too high, he may hesitate. But eventually, I think he will follow the U.S. administration.
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts. That's Shlomo Abram, policy analyst and retired brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Force. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let me take you back to May 29th.
There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller stood before reporters to speak for the first and only time about his investigation into connections between President Trump and Russian influence on the 2016 election. Mueller has been subpoenaed by two congressional committees, and he's now agreed to testify. So what'll we hear? Here's what he said back in May.
The report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Nonetheless, Mueller's date with Congress is set for July 17th. He's got two public appearances scheduled for that day with the House, Judiciary, and Intelligence Committees in a political spectacle that may generate more heat than light. As Mueller also said last month, just read the report. It has become something that large corporations, hospitals, and local governments all have to plan for: how to respond if they're hit by hackers with a ransomware attack. That's when computer systems are locked up and held hostage until the target pays up. The BBC's cybersecurity reporter Joe Tidy visited a Norwegian company that is still recovering from one of those attacks.
Glasses.
As well as the usual protective clothing required to visit a modern factory, here, earplugs are essential. An aluminium plant in full swing is deafening. But on one night in March, when hackers struck, everything had to stop. Computer systems went down simultaneously. A ransom note from hackers appeared on screens. Pay us, or you'll be locked out forever. And it wasn't just here. Norsk Hydro's 170 sites around the world were all affected. 35,000 employees forced to use pen and paper. It's been 5 weeks now, but production manager Olav Skulstad describes to me what it was like at his site in Magna, near Norway's eastern border.
This is another one of our computers that went down. Here, everything coming out from the aging oven. You can see which frames coming, which number they have, and where they are going for the next station.
So that was all gone?
All gone.
Thanks to some long-retired workers and some long-forgotten-about paperwork, he managed to keep things running manually, the old-fashioned way. But eventually, things did grind to a halt.
I think it was worse than when the plant started 50 years ago, because at that time it also had some kind of system.
Down here on the factory floor, where these heavy-duty machines are working hand-in-hand with people, every minute counts. You can see why the hackers wanted to target a place like this. I bet they thought they could name their price.
But they never got the chance. At the company's headquarters in Oslo, they took the decision not to negotiate with hackers.
So this is the note here that people would see if they open the file.
So it says, "Greetings, there was a significant flaw in the security system of your company. Your files are encrypted with the strongest military algorithms."
As chief information officer for the company, Yoda Vliga is patiently trying to get the company's systems back up and running.
As we were being attacked, we had to shut down the entire network. 40 countries, 22,000 PCs. And now here we are selectively allowing network communication between people, systems, plants.
So you're very much still recovering from this then?
We're still very much recovering. We don't trust anything.
It's estimated the hackers would have asked for around £300,000 in untraceable Bitcoin. Instead, Norsk Hydro has spent more than $45 million recovering, and they're still months away from finishing.
I think in general it's a very bad idea to pay. It's probably financing other sorts of crime.
But there are plenty of companies who are paying and keeping it secret. Sources in the information security industry have described multiple occasions when large, well-known companies have paid huge ransoms and not told the public, shareholders, or even the authorities. To understand the scale of the problem, we need to go to an unlikely part of America. Here, paying hackers ransoms is an open secret.
But there is one firm here in this small town in Connecticut that is happy to speak. They specialise in negotiating the ransoms between the victims and the hackers.
You know, this group will divvy up 80% of the Bitcoin, 20% goes to the developer.
Coveware is just one of a handful of companies that have started helping victims navigate the murky world of cyber extortion. CEO and founder Bill Siegel deals with hackers every day.
We always have at least half a dozen to a dozen cases.
Are these big companies?
Some of them, yeah. Public companies and name brands.
Industry analysis suggests that overall, ransomware attack numbers are actually in decline. But some estimates suggest that attacks on businesses have gone up 500% in the last year. And as hackers go after bigger targets, the ransoms are going up.
We always want them to be as small as possible or to not happen. But we recognize that when a company needs to pay and it's a large number, then that's what needs to happen. And that can be seven figures.
How do you feel when you pay seven figures?
Not good. It's not a good outcome.
Cyber extortion expert Bill Siegel speaking there with the BBC's Joe Tidy. We close the hour in Senegal, West Africa today. I was there in 2012 when the country's best-known musician, Youssou N'Dour, tried running for president. That's one of his many hits, Birima. Youssou N'Dour, though, was prevented from running for president 7 years ago. The candidate he ended up supporting, Macky Sall, did win and was re-elected earlier this year. Incidentally, this week, the president's brother was forced to resign a government post after our own partners at the BBC investigated his role in a suspicious gas deal. Nevertheless, Youssou N'Dour told me he's proud of the democracy that Senegal upheld in February's re-election of Macky Sall.
I'm really happy with this result because even we win, good win, but there's a 42% people who say no, we don't want you again. And, you know, all these elements make Senegal, you know, a vitrine of democracy.
A window for democracy.
Window for democracy. No one can change the result.
Youssou N'Dour has a new album out titled History, and given his own role in Senegalese history, you'd be forgiven for thinking it's a reflection on politics. But it's a musical retrospective featuring old Youssou compositions that he's updated.
This one's for my father, and his father is about where we come from, not about what you run from.
Whoa, Birima.
One of the songs that you prize on History is Birima, fantastic song, and you perform it with Sini Bosse. Who is she, and why did you want to work with her?
She's a Senegalese, Gambian, and Swedish. She came to me and present me the idea she had of the song and explained me all her story with her father, who died, passed away. She grew with the song. She grew with this melody. She grew with my music. She want to return back.
So she lives in Sweden, and she wanted to be kind of like more connected to Senegal.
Yeah, to Senegal and Gambia. And when I listened to the song, you know, I was really touched. And I say, yeah, I'm ready to sing it again with you.
New music there from Youssou N'Dour along with singer Sena Bosse. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be back with you tomorrow. And his father is about where we come from, not about what you run from.
RI, Public Radio International.